Stephen.
Hello.
Hello. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, good to see you again. We're in the probably the hottest, it's like hot yoga, but hot podcasting.
Yeah.
So for anyone who's watching, please excuse us if we're, or can hear the sound of sweat dripping from us. I think, Stephen, you got to explain yourself. Why on earth is it so warm?
Well, we were doing so much to offset climate change outside this room that we felt we had to compensate inside. No, jokes aside, we just had a bit of an HVAC issue the last few days, which is great for some of the business around the corner selling chilled beverages. But in the meanwhile, is very much encouraging the hybrid working environment we've had to adopt for the last few years for a bit longer.
Yeah, it's like 30 degrees in here. So I almost took my shoes off earlier. I was like, is it weird if I take my shoes off in Zenobi's office? I think it probably would have been.
We had some people running around with sort of ties at the top and cargo shorts at the bottom. So this is a safe place, no judging.
Yeah. Stephen, thanks for coming on. I mean, we have wanted to get you on for ages because Zenobi doesn't need much introduction, but one of the things we're going to do today on the podcast, we've had a lot of feedback from people who have been getting in touch the last couple of weeks, which is awesome. If you're listening, please do carry on. And we've heard that people want to hear the founder story a bit more. So today I'm going to dig into the background of you and Zenobi and how you got here. Mm-hmm. But before we start, Zenobi almost needs no introduction, right? Mm-hmm. So a company that has, I don't know whether it's right to say, has been through some pivots or has expanded into new opportunities. And some really interesting ones from you guys being a battery developer, your previous name, which was Bez, if I remember correctly. A few of you guys started small and went very, very big, very fast in batteries in the UK. And now to a company that manages, operates, finances electric bus fleets globally. Mm-hmm. So what I want to do today is dig into how did we get here? Yep. But firstly, let's start with you, Stephen. So who are you?
Yeah, well, Steve Meersman, electrical mechanical engineer from Belgium, tried to do an MBA in the States and get into finance, as so many engineers do, but got saved from a career in banking by the financial crisis. So I arrived there in 2008 in the summer and ended up working with two guys who had the crazy idea of setting up a battery business inside a big utility, AES, which eventually later on became Fluence. So that was my first foray in batteries, and it took about three more times for that to stick.
What year is this?
Is 2008. So we did the first few batteries, I think, possibly in all the Americas, right? We had the first battery in California, just outside New York, and then the first in the Atacama Desert in Chile, powering a lithium mine, of all things. And that was all quite novel. I mean, battery prices were, what was it, $2.3 million a megawatt hour.
Wow.
We had to register it as a mini coal plant in order to get through all the tick boxes of the various ISOs. So it was all quite novel. To me, it was a bit niche at the time. So I got lured away to become part of a team at Oliver Wyman that was setting up a small team focused on commodity infrastructure and that sort of stuff. So oil, gas, power, which is very interesting. And then, as so many consultants do, ended up going into industry, working for Trafigura, who'd been buying a lot of the midstream assets, terminals, refineries that all the big majors had been selling off and trying to optimize those. So learned a lot about optimization and managing portfolios, et cetera. There.
Oil and gas we're talking about here.
Yes, and gas. And then couldn't stay away from batteries. So I had a friend of mine who set up EOS Energy Storage, the zinc oxide manufacturers in New Jersey. So they asked for some help with raising funds. So that was the second time I did that on the side. And then eventually when I left Trafigura and I was on my gardening leave trying to figure out, well, what do I do next? People kept asking me about batteries in Europe.
What year are we in now?
This is now 2013 to 15. Okay. And then eventually got introduced through the Oliver Wyman network to James, who'd sold his business to Oliver Wyman, his consulting private equity business.
So it's James Basden.
James Basden,
one of the
exactly.
founders at Zenobi.
Yeah. He was still at Oliver Wyman at the time, but he introduced me to Nicholas, Nicholas Beatty, exactly, yeah. Who had been, fighting a wind farm near Milton Keynes. And had a sort of an epiphany moment where he said, well, actually, if I build a solar farm, I'll take the capacity out of the wires and then they can't put up the wind farm. And then eventually that led them to building batteries on the solar farm as well. So, I mean, it's possible to do lots of good things for a variety of reasons. And that's what got him into this sector. That was with Inesco at the time.
Yep.
And as many battery developers at that time, 2015-16, they found a challenge that how do you explain this to investors, right? It's very merchant, even though we had 2-year contracts then. It's very novel and it's very small. So they were struggling to get the city to invest in these projects. So we said, well, we might be interested in buying a few of these projects because then we could get into the market, get cash flows, and then hire a team and grow this into a business based on a few key fundamentals. We're an island. We're adopting more renewables. Stability is going to be an issue, and that's all going to fall on its face if we don't have batteries.
So at this stage, it's the three of you. It's you, James, and Nicholas.
Yeah.
And you, between you, have decided you're going to start buying some sites.
Not some sites, some operating batteries.
Some operating
batteries. Operating batteries.
From an ESCO.
Yeah, from an ESCO, exactly. So as we did that, we also realized that these battery weren't necessarily very well optimized because people always went after the low-hanging fruit, firm frequency response at the time, and just throwing darts at a board in terms of what will the price be this month. Now, we started then investing in our data science capabilities. I had a bit of a background in that in the States. So we started building our own modeling tools to be more sophisticated in how we bid in the auctions.
At this time, the company's not Zenobi yet, though, is it?
No, it's called BESS.
It's called BESS.
Yeah, Battery Energy Storage Solutions, which does what it says on the tin.
BESS Limited. I remember getting I still might have one of Nicholas Beattie's old cards somewhere.
Yeah.
It says BESS on it.
Yeah.
There's three of you in the company now, or have you got others?
Yeah, we just hired our first employee, Ned Bonsonby, who's been with us since day one, basically. And
you're in London?
We were hiding out in Costa Coffees, pilfering meeting rooms at our lawyers' offices, etc., just because we didn't have a stable base, because on one side we were raising the funds and on the other side trying to do the seed transaction with an ESCO, which sort of closed around March 2017. Again, we'd had probably every door in the city slammed in our face, so we went the private route. So we got it's always good to have friends who are more successful than you, and that helped with raising money and starting the business.
This is small amounts, right, compared to where you guys are now. What sort of money were you raising?
I think our first raise was about 700K to do the diligence, and then another 7 million to buy the first sets of assets, so 4 megawatts plus.
And we're going to talk about much bigger numbers than that later. But yeah. That was to buy 4 megawatts, you say?
4 megawatts and then some development rights on further sites. Yeah.
All right. And these are BYD systems, right?
These were BYD system, some of the first BYD batteries that landed in this country. Yeah.
Okay. So containerized batteries from China, the biggest.
Sitting in a field on the distribution network, providing the low hanging fruit at the time, which were the few markets that batteries were actually allowed to participate in at that time. And obviously, we've seen the market evolve a lot since then. We've gone through, markets, 2-year contracts, very high prices. Then I think late September 2017, sort of had the first crash, going to month contracts. Prices dropping to £3 to £6.
Yeah.
But the energy system is like a balloon, right? You squeeze one end, the value moves to the other side. And that's where we realized we have to invest, like I said, in that data science capability to understand the system. Where's the value going to move for flexibility? And then also work with software developers to develop our own dispatch system so we could exert a lot more control over the battery, deliver the same service with putting less energy through the systems. We've got less degradation, finer control. And we were the first battery in fast reserve, which...
I remember.
Yeah.
Everyone was like, what? What's this fast reserve thing? We thought that was for other guys. We thought
that was for
peakers or, you know,
Hydro,
diesel.
Right?
Hydro,
our first contract was an emergency tender because one of the hydro plants, I can't remember which one, went down for a couple of weeks. And we had just passed qualification, so we could just bid into it, and then
so this
luckily
was,
won.
I don't think fast reserve really happens anymore, does it? But this is 2017-ish, I remember.
This is September 2017, or was it early 2018? I can't remember.
And they used to buy a season at a time, I think.
Yeah.
And you got paid, you had to respond within a minute, was it, I think?
Yeah, but you had to, duration could be indefinite. But you could put constraints on your bid so that nobody had really tested what the value was for a limited duration technology like a battery. So we'd been engaging with National Grid, also analyzing all the auction data. And that's, I think, what's great about this market is there's so much data flying around. You can see bidding strategies of the various parties, technologies, limitations, and then try and work out where the value is and tweak. And that's, again, very similar to the oil industry, where they move so many barrels of oil, and people get excited about an extra penny per barrel because you move a whole lot of barrels. And I think the approach we take to energy storage and to e-mobility or heavy-duty e-mobility is the same. You're doing many miles or you're moving many kilowatt hours. How do you continuously optimize just that tiny bit more?
It's like pro cycling. You take a watt off your your aerodynamics and, well, it makes no difference to me, but perhaps to...
Yeah.
But coming back to it, right? So it's the year 2017. You guys have got... You've got a couple of batteries by then?
Yeah, so we had in 2017, we had about 4 megawatts operational across 4 sites.
Did you bid into EFR, by the way?
No, we didn't.
You didn't? So you didn't. That was 2016. Yeah. Didn't bid into EFR.
Can't get them all right. We were like, that's way too low value for what it is. But we also, it was a strategic choice as well. We didn't believe 30-minute systems were where it's at. We felt batteries needed to be like Swiss pocket knives, so you want longer duration, the right balance between duration and power to access as many, services as possible.
So you were building 1-hour systems back then, all BYD?
They were all BYD at the time. We did eventually open it up with, I think we had the first sizable Tesla system just outside of Leicester.
Hill Farm,
2018 we are then, I think.
That's a very, very good looking battery, actually. It's because it's a Tesla system, which has got a bit of magic dust. Yeah. And then it's also covered in a sort of barn thing, isn't it?
The wondrous world of planning permissions.
Indeed. Yeah. You were building the Tesla system. We're jumping around, sorry. Yeah. But the philosophy was, we believe that marginal gains are really important and that we can invest in data science and technology.
Yeah.
And you were starting to build a portfolio of grid scale batteries. So by 2017, bear in mind, there wasn't much about then. I mean, we look back and we've got a gig and a half now, but back then it was hard.
Yeah.
It was really hard. Convincing everybody who's never heard of this thing before that A, it exists, and B, it won't blow up, and C, it can make money.
Yeah.
And so what was the strategy about building more assets? How are you going into
We felt, I mean, as we said, the comment about pennies on the kilowatt hour, that only works if you've got a lot of kilowatt hours. So we sort of had a plan over a period of time to go to about 120 megawatts. That was the initial strategy. Try and go for maximum optionality, so assets that can provide as many services as possible. I mean, some of the early ones we got into reactive power trials with UKPN and various other bits. But what also had happened is, because we'd invested in that dispatch system, the Link to National Grid, PAS, as it was called, and for Fast Reserve.
What does that stand for?
This is really blast from the past.
Platform for Ancillary Services?
Something like that, yeah.
Because you needed that for store, and you guys, instead of...
Everybody's like, why is Zenobi doing PAS? Because it's got... Surely they're not going to do store, and obviously it was for Fast
I remember, because I was an aggregator, and we were like, what, Zenobi's building their own PAS system? What?
Yeah.
They did it.
Yeah.
Because you had to do it for Fast Reserve, I think,
didn't
you?
Exactly. Yeah. That was the reason. So, and since that, we've moved on. Because if you look at what we're doing now, is like the 100 megawatt Capenhurst project, etc. We're taking that to the next logical step, which is looking for key points in the grid where there is a choke point, a bottleneck, or extra optionality. So the reactive power, the other national grid pathfinders, and then supplement that with the merchant income streams from Fast Reserve, DC, DR, DM, etc., etc. So it's that mix between the two. Because I think where we added one pillar, right? First, we started with the sort of the engineering and the financing. We then added the data science. And now we're leaning back into the engineering piece to really push that to the next level and sweat these assets even more. And I think it's those three pieces coming together that are important to us in everything we do.
So one thing I haven't asked you, and I should have done at the start, is, Stephen, what is Zenobi?
What is Zenobi, or where does the name come from?
Let's do the name too. But I think I know what Zenobi is, but I put. What's the company?
I mean, we own and operate batteries, right? And that could take different guises. So we started with grid scale, but if you look at heavy duty e-mobility, to a large extent, they're batteries on wheels, or the batteries are a big part of the cost, or a big part where optimization can happen as the energy and transport network merges. And what we are is an owner-operator.
What does heavy-duty e-mobility mean to the layman?
Buses, trucks, boats, last-mile delivery vans, and anything sort of above 3 tons, I would say.
Okay, so big, heavy vehicles on the road.
That do lots of miles. In our cities. So big impact on air quality and other elements. And we feel that by focusing there, we can have the biggest impact in the shortest amount of time, positive sense, but also secondly, it works for that earlier strategy that I said, which is looking for optimizing flexibility, because again, they do lots of miles. So if you can tweak tiny bits off and help our customers save money, we can make the ecologically sustainable solution also the financially sustainable one. And that's something that if you go to our big batteries, it's true as well. It's just that the system there doesn't move, right? But we are doing the same for large utilities.
So are you seeing large-scale e-mobility? I think you had a heavy-duty e-mobility. Are you seeing that as a battery on wheels?
It's much more than that, but to an extent it is. I mean, where do we add the most value? It's on everything that touches the electrons, right? I mean, if you look at an electrical schematic, you've got a 40-foot container with a grid connection, or you've got a high-power charger and an electric bus. When you electrically draw that, it doesn't look that different.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of value that we can generate for the transport sector. Because if the transport sector goes electric, they do the most miles, they're in our cities, can have a very big impact. But to do that, you almost need to start at the end and work backwards, right? We are reusing the batteries that come out of the vehicles in grid scale storage. By doing that, there's less cost that needs to be recuperated in the first life. So you're making it easier for people to go electric. And that's how you get that sort of snowball event where buses, trucks, vans, etc. can really be the sort of leading the charge, or whatever pun you want to use, into decarbonizing other sectors. And that's what we get excited about.
Okay. So Zenobi is a business. You've got a grid scale storage business.
Yeah.
And you've got a big, heavy bus, truck, e-mobility business.
Yeah.
And all the supporting stuff around that, right? Charging stations and all the I want to talk about the complexity of that in a minute.
Yeah.
And then is there any other bits of any other tentacles that Zenobi is working on?
Well, we can't use tentacles because, I mean, Octopus very firmly has got all those analogies with them. But I would say we are touching other parts. I mean, it's the links between the two, right? So from the network infrastructure business, we understand grid connections. We understand how to make money with flexibility or save money with flexibility, which we bring to the heavy duty side, where that's becoming an important component, bringing down grid costs, monetizing flexibility when vehicles aren't being used. But also there's things coming back, which is batteries going into, old EV batteries going into a second life before they're being recycled back into the network infrastructure side. So those are the two links.
Oh, so to be clear here, this is batteries from buses, for example, being then used as in containers as grid scale solutions.
Or smaller systems, exactly.
But when they're not when they've been degraded too much for a bus, you can still use them elsewhere before you recycle them.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, because a 19-ton double-deck bus got about 2-3 tons of lithium on it, right? And that needs to do 250 miles a day. So at some point, it can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
And that's when the reason the battery goes off is because it might be too much dead weight or it doesn't have the range. But coming back to the point we touched on earlier, for batteries right now, their value lies in the difference between the ratio between how much power and how much energy they can consume. It's not all about the energy.
Yeah.
And that's where we see the opportunity to bringing two industries together and through doing that, helping decarbonize them both.
Okay. I'm going to ask you some quick fire questions here. Sure. So in the grid scale stationary storage industry, we've got a pretty firm idea of CapEx, which is, I'm not going to ask you for numbers, don't worry, but the battery is about half the cost. Roughly of the site, roughly.
Yeah.
What's it like for a bus?
Not that different.
Oh, is it not? Okay.
It's maybe a little bit lower, I would say, the ratio, but it's not far from that number. So for a round calculation, it's substantial, particularly if you factor in that these assets need to live a long time, right? They live the same as a grid scale storage site, 15, 20 years. This is critical infrastructure. And a battery might go for 5 to 8 years, or if you cook it, only 3. So you're going to have battery replacements. So it's a bit like the aircraft industry, where if you look at a Rolls-Royce engine on a plane or a GE engine, that needs refurbishing every 8 years, which costs about anywhere between 30 and 130% of the initial CapEx outlay, depending on how it was maintained. It's very similar.
The problem is, for Rolls-Royce and, GE and the people who, licensing those engines, they can make loads of money on the servicing and the blade replacement. But for batteries, there isn't much to service.
No, which...
So the commercial case is very different. I'm not saying, the model is very different.
Yeah, the model is different. And that's where the services piece and the other bits come. So helping people lower cost on their infrastructure by designing in the future proofing, designing in the fact that, a timed connection, or a flexible connection can bring down those costs, or putting a stationary storage system in a bus depot, like we've done. About one in three of our 27 depots has got a stationary storage device in the depot. Again, helps bring down those grid costs. And then once you've got the battery there, it can take solar off the roof and put it in the buses at night, or it can generate frequency services by pooling it with the rest of our portfolio. And that's, again, how we bring cost down for the customer and create a role for us.
So operationally, buses are very, I'm going to stick with the buses for a while.
It speaks to the imagination.
It's really interesting. Yeah, it does, right? Yeah. Because stationary storage, grid storage, it's available, let's say, 100% of the time.
Yeah.
It's available to make money. But buses aren't, because
but they're making money while driving.
They
make
the money, yeah. And so they've got like two operational profiles. They've got making money, picking people up and taking them places, or delivering stuff. It's a great value proposition, don't get me wrong. You know, taking electricity and turning that into movement for people, brilliant.
Yeah, it's the highest value application.
Yes. But then at night, unless they're night buses, I don't know whether that happens.
Yeah.
They're sat there overnight charging, I assume?
It's a big operational change, because before what would happen, the bus would come in, it would get fueled up, it'd go through the car wash, it'd get parked, and you wouldn't have to touch it. And now suddenly you have mixed fleets, right? So how do you get the electric vehicles through the car wash as quickly as possible, make sure they're not in that queue, get them to a charger as quickly as possible, make sure they don't get iced in the depot because there's something in the wrong spot, etc. And then making sure they're all parked up in the right order so they can, the bus that's the most full charge is the one that can go out first in the morning.
And so, to maximize
minimize the cost of the charging, right?
Yeah.
So you don't, if buses come back at 6, you don't want to start charging then. But also during the night, energy costs fluctuate, which people like to ignore. So we find ways of helping our customers with that, or sharing information, saying, well, actually on this day and on this route and with this vehicle and with this driver, your energy consumption is different. And the spread is wild. Like, we've got, done a comparison, same vehicle, same temperature, same route, same bus, and we had a 50% difference in energy consumption. Just different driver, different traffic situation. So if we can give feedback on that in a tangible way, we can get less energy to go through the battery. It's great for the customer, they save on energy cost. It's great for us, because at the end of the journey, we get a better battery back that we can use a bit longer in our second life application. And that's why the financing is so important, because we own it. Or both our noses, us, the customer, and the OEM, is all pointing in the same direction. We're looking after that asset and trying to maximize value.
So who's the customer for Zenobi in the electric bus? Let's just talk about bus fleets to start with, because I think they're the most exciting to me, but I'm a bit of a geek. So you guys do electric buses. Who's the customer, and what's the value proposition to them?
Yeah, the private operators, I mean, you've got the Stagecoaches, the Go-Aheads, the National Expresses, the Newport Transports, etc. of this world. Some of them council-owned, some of them private. They operate routes either on a commercial basis or on a contract, say, for TfL. They need to go electric, right? It's been mandated in some areas, right? Low emissions or TfL and other areas saying, look, we're only accepting electric bids. So they have to do it. So for them, the value of working with somebody like us is that we take the hassle factor out of it, the experience, and we help bring costs down. As they go on this journey, so they can focus on their core business. Because if you've ever had an opportunity to go to a bus depot at night, I'd highly recommend to do it once at least, because the amount of effort involved in keeping all these buses running is enormous. Getting them repaired, maintained, so that they go out every morning is a fight. So when you suddenly then switch to a new technology, it's challenging, right? Because the driver, he didn't have a fuel gauge before. And now suddenly he sees SOC sort of shrinking before his eyes. It's terrifying.
State of charge, yeah.
The CFO of the business sees that he's got the same number of seats, so the same number of tickets they can sell, and the asset is twice as expensive.
Capex-wise.
Yeah. And then the engineer in the depot goes from dealing with drives and oil and this and that, suddenly dealing with 800-volt DC systems. Everyone is, I wouldn't say terrified, but it's a big change. It's probably the biggest change, and in my view, the most exciting change probably for the last few decades.
So how do they, so say I'm Stagecoach, or I won't use a name, but one of these bus operating companies. Before now, did I lease diesel buses?
Yeah.
And so have you had to slot into an existing operating model as Zenobi?
Well, similar to the batteries, right? I mean, when we started with the grid-scale batteries in 2016, the only way we can get the banks to fund it was basically to say, look, this is actually, forget it's a battery, it's a diesel generator. Let's pretend it's a diesel generator. You fund those.
Yeah.
These are the revenue streams that are similar. This is a bit different. That is a bit different. But actually, the difference is not that big. That's how we started. So obviously, on the bus and the truck and these other segments, we've had to do the same. It's how do we make this look as much as possible like the way you've been running something before? It's all about user experience in the end. So how do we make this as easy and as smooth as possible and give you the comfort that, yes, this will work. And if it doesn't work, we'll be on top of it and we'll let you know what we're doing, etc. Yeah. It's all about that user comfort.
So do you fund these on balance sheet?
We fund them with our capital, right? We are an owner-operator. And I think, again, that's important because we've got, to use that dreadful expression, skin in the game. but we do have banks funding us as well, right? So we use our own equity as well as bank facilities. I mean, the corporate finance team recently put a press release out. We did about 270 million private placement for, on one side with banks, for a sort of warehousing facility. On the other side, we got pension fund and insurance fund money into the sector, which is longer dated, different cost of capital. Again, bringing costs down, right? You can engineer your way out of a problem, bringing the grid connection costs down. You can software data science your way out of a problem by looking for efficiencies. We can also finance your way out of a problem by aggregating demand, aggregating different customers who might struggle on their own to get financing and making it part of a pool and syndicating that to lower the perceived risk to the banks. So again, it's these three bits coming together, same as you would have had in those 100 to 200 megawatt projects we're developing
now. And I just want to talk about scale for a second, because we probably should have touched on this at the beginning. So if we start with grid scale batteries and then the e-mobility side, what kind of megawatts or number of buses or number of chargers or whatever? Where are you guys at right now? I haven't prepared you for this question.
Yeah, so I'm just trying to think, because the number changes on a almost a weekly basis. But I think we're currently at about 180 megawatts operational, another 100 and something in build.
In grid storage,
and a gigawatt or something in development or more for the next, say, 2 to 3 years.
So let's over a gig and a half there of stationary storage.
Well, we like to talk about what we've built, not so much what we're going to do. Because I remember if you were there in the early days, the braggawatts of everyone had gigawatt pipelines and all. So we move very much against that. We talk about what we've done. On the bus side, I think we've currently got about 660 electric buses.
660 buses?
Electric buses operational across UK, Australia, New Zealand.
Wow.
So that's about, if you look at that in megawatts, that's about, it's roughly half a megawatt hour per bus, so between 300 and half. So let's take half, it's about 300 megawatts on wheels.
So you've got about the same grid storage and storage on wheels. I had no idea there was that many. So six, and I'm going to say some things that might wind you up now. Aren't electric buses maturing technology but still immature? And does that mean that they're being iterated on with technology and cooling and management? And so do you have older legacy buses and newer, more fantastic buses?
Well, I would say we've a few comments there. I think the first thing is buses and trucks, they need to last for 10, 15 years, or in some places even longer than that. So it's infrastructure, so there is an amount of inertia in the technology, and also backwards compatibility, as you can imagine, is a big topic, making sure that you can continue to service what you've had before.
A three-pin plug.
Yeah. we've seen technology evolve, I would say, even over the last few years, but the buses that we drive now in some ways are still performing a similar function to 100 years ago, right? They're carrying people from A to B and navigating traffic and going through all these challenges. So I would say there's a lot that happens under the hood, and in some cases with leaps and bounds still, if you look at chemistry evolution, because again, there's now so much more data coming off these electric buses than there was perhaps before with diesel vehicles. So you've got a lot more information that people can then take actions on. So I think the iterations of that sort of incremental improvement, the speed of that is increasing, as in a lot of other industries as well. But we shouldn't forget electric buses actually aren't that new in a weird way, because I think in China, they started really going at it in 1992. And in London, the last petrol electric bus, which was sort of a hybrid one, was in drove in London in 1912. Because before that, they were all hybrids. And nothing is truly new if you want to get philosophical about it. But I do think there's still a lot of evolution happening in the space, because it's not just about a bus. It's also about coaches, about community transport, about special educational needs, children needing to get to places. And so we're seeing that people are experimenting with the format of a bus. It's not always a double-decker. Sometimes it can be a minibus in demand-responsive transport and integrating with the Ubers, etc. of this world. Sometimes a bus can actually be a taxi that somehow integrates into the same smooth multimodal transport network. So there's a lot of innovation happening there. I mean, you've got the electric scooters now. Yeah. How do they fit into the network? TBD. I mean, there's a lot of evolution still happening in the planning, the software, and the scheduling, etc. So I think there's a datafication or digitalization happening at the moment that's as exciting and perhaps not as visible if you look outside and say, yeah, the bus is still red. It was red yesterday.
Yeah.
What's changed?
I want to ask you about, so who makes these buses?
Variety of people. I mean, initially on electric, China very much stole the lead, given that they've very strategically said, thou shalt make electric buses.
I was in China a few years ago, 5 years, and we couldn't believe it, how half of everything on the road was electric.
Yeah.
And that was 5 years ago.
Well, it's the only way they were going to get the car industry away from Germany, right? So I think that was a very strategic, prescient choice of them. But we are seeing the European and US manufacturers invest a lot and catch up as well. Daimler, Mercedes, Caetano, Van Hall. There's lots of OEMs now have got electric. Solaris in Poland. Lots of them got electric products. And there's some new entrants coming into the field as well, right? Proterra in the US, although I guess after 10 years, can I still describe them as new? It's exciting. I think that new technology, causing innovation with the incumbents, but also bringing new entrants to the party and people sort of thinking, what is a bus, effectively?
And what can we talk about charging for a moment?
Sure.
We're energy bots, right? On this podcast, generally, we tend to be battery people. How fast can you charge an electric bus? And what sort of connections do you need? I know how long is a piece of string, but what's reasonable to expect at a charging station?
I mean, I think all our chargers, I guess, if they were on the public road, would be classified, I guess, as ultra fast. So they're sort of 120 kilowatts or above in many cases. But in some cases, it's horses for courses, right? If you've got a bus that's got 8 hours to charge and a half a megawatt battery, you don't need a 350 kilowatt pantograph or anything like that. So it's sort of a total cost of ownership optimization. Do I want charge speed? What's the servicing? What's the CapEx? What's the OpEx? It's like with the whole debate about electric versus hydrogen, and I won't wade into that, but the one comment I would make is, what's the value of a 1,000-kilometer bus if most buses do 250 miles, right? So, I mean, the incremental kilometer doesn't really add that much more in this particular use case. In other use cases, it might. So I think there, this sort of focus on faster, 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 I would go more for more reliable, getting more data out of the inside of the charger. Because we're working these things hard, right? If you look at a public charge, if it has 12 sessions that last less than half an hour at 80% of the speed, that's a good charger, right? With us, we're talking about 4 hours full blast every night, possibly twice
DC,
a day. So that's the equivalent of like 20 sessions or whatever. So we are working the technology hard.
Yeah. And again, coming back to sort of rules of thumb here. So about half a megawatt hour in a bus. This is a single decker normal bus. Mm-hmm. I'd say normal. It carries like 50 people. I don't know.
Something like that.
For reference, a Tesla Model 3, what's that, like 100 kilowatt hours? Something like that. So you're about five Tesla Model 3s in a bus.
Yeah.
And it will do about 250 miles a day. It would probably do more than that.
Yeah, I would say between 150 and 250 probably. Yeah.
And that's enough for it to do it round. Yeah. Do it round.
I mean, 80% of there was a study, this was pre-COVID by TfL, that 80% of the bus routes in London could already be done with a fully degraded sort of first, second gen battery.
Wow.
So
I want to ask you two more questions now. What about the future? What about the future and what about the past?
Mm-hmm.
So the one about the past, we'll do that one first.
Mm-hmm.
Zenobi's been through a few iterations, right? I've been pretty impressed by how you guys have made lots of small bets and mm-hmm. then found the ones that win and doubled mm-hmm. down on them. And doubled
is that
down
how it looks from the outside? That's way more organized than it might
that's
be.
What, that's
yeah.
well, also, you know, we've chatted for a few years yeah, and I've heard a bit of the inside story.
Yeah.
And just for the listeners and people who are watching, how as an organization has Zenobi managed to do that? You know, and to what's the thinking and the structure behind the thinking mm-hmm. that has meant that you've gone from Bez to Zenobi, the e-mobility company, to yeah. who knows what next?
Well, I think there's a bit between strategy and overanalyze. I mean, you do need to do analysis to sort of know what the fundamentals of a business are before you get into it and how that evolves and how those assumptions change. And we've seen that in the energy storage market in the UK and elsewhere. I think on the other side is the pragmatism. When you see an opportunity that you can, that it has a time-limited window, then you can't wait until you've got 100% of the information. You need to act when it's sort of at 75 or 80% of the information, because otherwise the opportunity will be gone, right? See Fast Reserve, etc. Did we know when we wanted to get into Fast Reserve that eventually what we built there would power 600 buses and control the charging in various cities? No. But we were, with every sort of incremental step, we were building more flexibility and optionality. So like you said, we would have the option of making several small bets, or every next step on the staircase gives more flexibility to then do an evaluation, very much in a sort of a bit of a trader, or physical oil trader mentality, in the way of saying, look, what's my second best alternative? Oh, this is better than my second best alternative. Let's go for that. Or I've got flexibility here. I don't need to take this to its logical end conclusion because I'm already getting value from what I'm doing here. Maybe a concrete example is that software system, because initially we didn't say, oh, we're going to do turnkey buses. We said we'd worked out that we put a battery in a depot, you can solve a grid constraint, right?
So we started with nothing on wheels yet.
We started with charging as a service. So we put a small battery in a field. This was with Stagecoach in Guildford, which was our first project, where through common contacts, we'd heard they had an issue. They had 9 buses they needed to charge, and the grid connection was going to take 2-3 years, going to cost an absolute fortune. And they knew they had to leave the site potentially in 5 to 7 years because it might be developed as an industrial warehouse or something. So how do you make the investment in a substation when you know you might need to move? It's difficult. We worked out, well, actually, in theory, we could put a battery there, connect the, as I said, electrically speaking, it's not that different, connect the chargers to the same software, and we could do that project to help someone. But then actually, when we got more information, we worked out that actually that wasn't just a theory thing. We could actually build that. And then actually we could build that, I think, in 6 weeks, of which 2 weeks over Christmas. It's again a deadline. The engineers have said, I can't promise anymore.
It's always Christmas.
Yeah, it's
Christmas,
always Christmas.
Thanksgiving, Easter.
Yeah. And we did that. And then we worked out through that process. There were so many stakeholders involved in these projects. And the customers were sort of crying out for sort of one throat to choke, that basically said, look, it's that person's fault and they're sorting out everything underneath. And then we realized that charging as a service could have a future. And it's only then, again, by speaking to the customer, doing this addressing, well, what are your issues? Listening to the customer, be it dealing a utility or a bus operator, it's pretty much the same. You try to understand what are they saying, why are they saying what they're saying, and have I really heard what the underlying root causes are? And we worked out then that the second big issue was the ownership of the batteries. And we're like, well, hold on. We own and operate batteries. We understand what they can do. Is there something we can do? And then we started doing the battery on the bus. And then the other bits sort of fell into place after that. I can't really claim that we had fully expected that perhaps it would move as quick as it did, or that we'd move into these turnkey aspects as quickly as we had expected. But we had sown the seeds for that, and we thought, yeah, it can evolve in that direction, but there's a few things that need to go right along the way.
But an organization, I mean, there's how many of you are there? 60, 70?
At that point, we were about, with Guildford, I think about 11 people.
But now you're a lot more, right?
We are about 111 people
Completely underestimated that.
Yeah.
So that feeling of, you know, yeah, as an organization, you need to have people that are comfortable with uncertainty and just seeing how things go, right? With all these little pathways and seeing what happens next. And then my question to you is, because I'm interested, we're doing the same at Modo, right?
Yeah.
We were like trying to do optimization, then we're the leaderboard company, then we're sort of turning into the Bloomberg of energy storage, and then who knows what else?
Yeah.
And so the question is, how have you as an organization managed to have that culture where people are comfortable in the uncertainty about. Yeah. You can't do the Elon Musk, which is, I'm going to do a Roadster, I'm going to do a model, whatever it is, Model S, Model 3. That's amazing, but not all businesses can come up with that 10-year plan.
Yeah.
And you guys have just sort of, you've just been confident enough to feel your way and say, if there's an opportunity, I'm going to hit it. How do you get an organization comfortable with that? Well, with 100 people?
I think what's helped with us a lot is that there were three of us from the start with very different backgrounds, right? James Basden coming from sort of consulting utility background, Nicholas coming from corporate finance, myself sort of trading and engineering. And that mix is something that actually we've kept going all the way through to 110. So you create an environment where different perspectives can get discussed and can make decisions quickly, but you can also spar, which sometimes as the lone founder is difficult. So I think that's something that helps. I think the second piece is you need to invest time in that. Spend time with the team and not just, you don't want to micromanage people. You want to sort of say, look, this is why we're doing this. And you can make some predictions, right? If I look at, we did this a while back, which is sort of interesting, went back to one of our early investor decks, and actually we said we would have, 120 megawatts by 2019, and we did. It's just that a third of it had wheels, right? So yes, you need to make these small, sometimes tactical, sometimes pragmatic, sometimes strategic decisions to course correct, but I think the overall direction was always clear. We said, look, we want to own and operate energy storage in its variety of forms, and we want to optimize a system, and that's why we believe that being an owner of the assets is a very important mentality. And those things you can decide on: mentality, attitude, bringing people in with the right sort of view on things, specialist but open to can communicate with other people. Then those things sort of come more naturally than if you try to be too specific about what you want to do, I think.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a rambly answer, sorry for
no,
that.
No, it's hard, right? Yeah. It's hard. It wasn't a rambling answer, but you explained Zenobi's view on it. And yeah, all credit to you guys for pulling it off. So my final question is about the future.
Mm-hmm.
Where's Zenobi headed? So you guys have probably hundreds of millions of pounds of assets. I don't know, have you gone above a billion yet? I don't know.
Depends on the currency you look at, yeah. But probably in that range, yeah.
Many companies would have IPO'd by now. You know, I'm not going to ask you for any non-public information, but it's more exciting about the vision of the company rather than where does the money come from.
Mm-hmm.
So, where's Zenobi headed? You know, what's the?
Well, just picking on two things, just reflecting on the last question a bit more. The other thing that's been really helpful for us is we've had very supportive shareholders, because I think when you have like a market rout like what happened in September 2017, you could have. A shareholder could jump in and say, oh no, we're going to take full control of everything, and then we probably wouldn't have been able to make these expansions that we've done, or like, what the hell are you doing with buses? We want containers, they're green.
Yeah.
Right? You wouldn't have been able to do that without supportive shareholders. And I think initially we had a large group of private individuals that we knew and had business relationships with. I think that helped a lot. Tiger, the private equity fund that came in as our first institutional, again, very supportive, and we've been able to keep that going throughout, even until the last raise with Infra Capital, putting in their 150 million. Again, very supportive, but have, even if they haven't dealt directly with storage or other things, have adjacent businesses, so they really understand and can think along and provide contacts or value beyond the money. I think that was another important ingredient of the past success, and I think also an important ingredient for the future in terms of where we're wanting to go. I think where we're wanting to go is that, well, continue doing what we're doing in an extent, right? Support our OEM customers even more, our OEM and operator customers even more, grow with them into new geographies, right? We had customers from here drag us into Australia and New Zealand. They're now dragging us into other places.
So I mean, your addressable market is huge,
yeah.
Right? And you're only just scratching the surface.
Yeah, continue to grow with that. Focus a lot on execution. That's the most important bit. Putting the customer front and center. And then slowly making, again, controlled small expansions beyond, because, well, we've got buses, they return to depot. What else returns to depot? Last mile delivery vans. So slowly expanding there in sort of adjacent sectors, but sticking true to the roots, which is we do B2B, storage as a service in various guises. We like working in electrical islands, right? Belgium and the Netherlands aren't geographic islands, but they are electrical islands. developing grid service markets. So we're sticking true to a few principles and yeah, trying to create more value for the customer, the shareholder, the partners on a per kilowatt hour and moving more of those. Because as we grow, you can start looking into things that you couldn't look at before, right? When we hired our first analyst to monetize 14 megawatts, he could only go after certain things, or well, was it he in this case, but could only go after certain things, right? But now we see that actually there's opportunities that were too small to look at 4 or 5 years ago. Because we've got a bigger portfolio now it's worth investing the effort to go after them. And I think that's what, when people talk about platform plays, I think that's what it's really about. And we've sort of, become that, I guess, over the years.
And one more cheeky question.
Sure.
Why on earth are you guys not doing hydrogen buses?
Well,
surely you should be doing hydrogen buses, Stephen.
Well, coming back to the principles is, where do we add value, right? We started as battery owners and operators. Now, hydrogen buses are interesting because there is a big battery on there, right? Because a fuel cell likes to run at a steady pace. You need something to absorb the shocks. And somewhere at that electrolyzer, because that hydrogen better be green if we get involved, there's going to be a battery there as well, because in order to get hydrogen at an economic cost, you need wind, solar, and a big battery to get you to the, 6,000-8,000 running hours that you need of production to do it economically. So there is a role for storage there, and there is a way for us to add value, but we're not hydrogen fuel chain experts yet, so we're focusing on the battery. Now, we have had some people approach us and say, well, actually, you've got your software, all these insights into transport, etc. Can you help us with our hydrogen buses? So I think there are some things we can do on the software side, the data science, and some of our other capabilities. And for existing customers, we'll do that. But in order to add as much value as we do on the electric bus side, I think there's a few things that would have to change, or that we'd need to understand better before we can properly do hydrogen. If I look at, say, the grid services piece, right? How do you do that with a charging hydrogen bus? Not entirely clear. The second life value from the battery coming off the vehicles, well, the batteries on hydrogen buses are a lot smaller. So we're finding our way there. I think we've got enough to go after. And
it was a bit of a naughty question, because I was wondering whether Zenobē has pinned its flag to electric buses over hydrogen fuel cells, or whether you're not sure yet.
Oh, I think the point is we're coming at it from our own perspective, right? We're a battery owner and operator across these two businesses, and batteries can go across between network infrastructure and fleet. Hydrogen would be a pure fleet bet, right? So I think from that perspective, I wouldn't say never, but it's perhaps slightly less obvious.
Yeah.
But like I said, we're now seeing, the software which we developed internally as an internal tool is now a tool we make available to some of our customers, right, who fitted the infrastructure themselves, bought the buses themselves, said, look, we just want to use your system for running it and have your data science and operational support. That is much more easily expandable to hydrogen or other technologies than perhaps some other elements of the offering. And then again, builds further optionality into expanding the business later on.
So last thing, anything you want to plug? Anything you want to plug, anything that you want to talk about, anything exciting that Zenobē is doing that you think our listeners should know about?
I think the Second Life piece is really cool. What we're doing with reusing old EV batteries to decarbonize construction, the event space, the film space. I think it's a small part of our business, but I think it's really exciting because we're closing the loop. And I think it's really important because, we talk a lot about carbon, and everybody talks about net zero, but I think personally that's getting into the foothills of where we need to get to, right? The Everest is still there to climb, microplastics, water drought, all that sort of stuff. So I think, we need to look at the bigger problem and not be daunted by it, but sort of do these small incremental steps, but still not lose the fact that net zero by 2050 is a pathetic ambition. We need to do it as quickly as we can, so we can start focusing on these other aspects if we want to keep this a livable place.
Awesome. All right, Stephen, we've run out of time. And I just want to say thanks for coming on and finding space in your calendar and for hosting us in this sauna.
Sauna, yeah. I mean, these plants grew up naturally. I think they've grown taller since we've been here.
Yeah, we've actually got the same ones, the IKEA ones. Thanks for coming on. For everyone who's watching, listening, as ever, we've been so pleased the last few weeks. We've had a few people get in touch and give us feedback. Please let us know what you're thinking. Comment, like, share. And we will see you on the next one. So thanks very much.